Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
So hey everybody, welcome to episode 232 of the More Than Just Code podcast. My name is Tim Mitchell and I am in Toronto, Ontario, freezing my butt off. And I'm joined once again by Jaime Lupez Jr. in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
And we also have Mark on the line down in San Jose, California.
Hello.
Alrighty. What's the temperature in California today, Mark?
It's not bad. I would say high 50s, low 60s.
Really? And how about you, Jaime?
It is low 50s and then high 30s for the low.
Right. Okay. So, well, as you know, I think probably people in Chicago and Minneapolis and New York probably know that we're currently in a polar vortex. And today in Canada, I've worked out the math for Tammy. We were talking about roundabout earlier today that it's -1 degree Fahrenheit today or -18 degrees Celsius for me. So
that's pretty cold.
Very cold. And today I learned that apparently a technique to keep the trains running is to set the rails on fire so that they're warm. I'm not joking. Like, it sounds like a joke, but apparently they actually do set them on fire to make sure they stay warm enough. Presumably the trains are not, you know, going over it while it is on fire. I think it's just to keep it warm so it doesn't freeze and, I don't know,
it
become dislodged
or, whatever, yeah.
Or shrink. Yeah, exactly. Shrink so the train won't actually fit on it, sort of thing.
Where do they light the train tracks on fire?
I think this was in the Chicago-ish area.
Oh, okay. Well, I do know that my son drives and teaches people to drive streetcars here in Toronto, and they have behind the driver's seat, well, in the older cars, there's like a cache of sand. And part of what they do as they're driving along is they drop a little bit of sand on the rails to keep them, to give them something to grip to in wet and snowy weather. So, and we also have all these, like, there's a mechanical switch that makes them, if they want to, you know, reroute them or turn a corner or something like that. And often the driver will get out and go with like a big spike and kind of like force the switch to change. So the other day when it was really bad snow, I had to get off the streetcar because the guy couldn't make the corner. So, because he couldn't get the switch to go. It was all frozen. Anywho.
The only Ask MTJC we seem to have post 23rd was you for NS North and Apple Pay.
What did I say? You have to go read it.
I mean, you just...
Oh, no, I have to open my my tweet deck thing, which I quit earlier because it runs out of memory. Oh, there's two of them. Yeah. So the first one is Ish and Rene Ritchie and James Thompson and Namrata are going to be speaking at NS North, and I'm not going to be able to make it because I'm going to be in Hawaii for a family thing. So, but my tweet says, but you should go, definitely. So if you're in anywhere near the north end of the United States or Canada, I highly recommend and you go to NS North, because this year it's going to be in Montreal, which will be a lot of fun. So yeah, they posted the speakers last week. The tickets went on sale this past Monday. So on the 28th. So I think it's $8.50 Canadian. So it's a bargain. You know, it's like 50 cents American, right? Isn't it?
Pretty close. It's like $6.20 or $6.50, something like that.
Yeah. So yeah, and it's going to be an 8-person workshop with Chris Idoff doing some advanced Swift. So that's probably going to get snapped up real quick. So if you're at all interested, and by the time the show comes out on Saturday, if the tickets are on sale for that, I would snap those up too. And I think that they only have about 250 people at NS North. So if you're sitting on the fence, you know, pitter patter, better get out there. All of us Canadians that don't like to go to the United States of America will be going to NS North. All right. The other one was what was this? We were talking about Apple Pay last week, and I was you know, throwing you guys some shade because we've had tap to pay here on our Interact cards and Visa cards for a long time, and that is the mechanism. The near field communication is the mechanism that Apple Pay uses on our pay terminals up here. So you know, there's like an NFC chip in the watch and I guess in the phones as well. So that's how we pay for things. But our oldest company in North America, if I'm not mistaken, the Hudson's Bay Company, or HBC as we call them up here, still do not have tap to pay. So we can't pay with Apple Pay there. And so I jokingly posted, I wonder if we can still pay with Hudson Bay blankets or beaver pelts, because that was their currency back then. And it seems to be still the currency today. So you have, like an animal, you have to reach into your wallet and pull out your Interact card or your Visa card and pay for things. Or you can use cash, like Mark said last week, right? So that's our Ask MTJC. All right, so do we have some follow-up, Jaime?
Yes, some very quick follow-up to last week where we talked about Microsoft saying that, hey, you should go get an iPhone or an Android phone because Windows 10 Mobile is no more. They're very serious. So Microsoft Office is now available on the Mac App Store.
Yay.
Just about all of them require some sort of subscription to Office 365. There is a one-month free trial. And then it's unclear to me if there's any sort of special deal between Apple and Microsoft on this. I suspect not. It's probably like, you know, the 15 to 30% that a company of that size would tend to pay for their cut of the subscription pricing and everything. So
It makes me sad too. I just upped my version of Microsoft to it says 1621, which I think is Microsoft. It's Office 2018. I just got a corporate deal to get that, but it doesn't include 365, unfortunately for me. So too bad. What else you got?
A whole bunch of things. Apparently, the beta of iOS 12.2 has revealed a multitude, a cornucopia perhaps, of secrets of upcoming things. So the first one here is from 9 to 5 Mac. It says that apparently the 12.2 beta includes a Hey followed by the word Siri setup interface for the AirPods 2. So it looks like it is revealing that a capability would exist on the AirPods and might be on the AirPods 2.
So what do you have to do now? You tap on them or something like that, right?
I think, you know, I was chatting with a friend today. It's like, it's a real bummer that I personally do not benefit from the AirPods because just the normal earbud shape and size just does not work with my particular ear canals. It starts hurting after a while. I'm very jealous of the people that it has worked for, the very many people it's worked for, because they seem to really enjoy those AirPods.
I seem to recall they don't fit Mark's ears either.
Yeah, they won't stay in my ears. They fall out.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I still use, I use the wired ones, and I'm constantly, like, now that we're in the winter time and we're shoveling snow, constantly catch myself, you know, with the cable or with the cord coming off of them. So I curse them all the time. But that said, you know, practically everybody at work has them. So I'm trying to save my money for other things, but what can you do? All right. What else you got?
For that air power, which is due any day now?
Air power? Oh, yeah. No. Nope.
Today I learned that Apple has provided air power that overheats so that you can keep the trains running. Don't put that on the show. That's such a bad one. It sounded funnier
like
in my head.
It's like a pocket warmer, right?
Yeah. They just got all the bad units and lined them up there on the L train in Chicago. But hey, Tim, you were talking about saving money. Well, here's a new way for Apple to get your money. So apparently, the images within the beta of iOS 12.2 reveal that there will be a magazine subscription service. We've heard about this rumor before. This is the most concrete thing I think we've seen. That there was a company. Is it here in the article? It is not here in this 9 to 5 Mac article. They acquired a news company of some sort, and it's kind of not a surprise that they're immediately, you know, turning that into a return on investment here.
Apple did.
They did.
It
had like a one word sort of thing, like talent or something of that nature.
You know what I mean? Yeah.
That's probably not the actual name of the company, but it had like a one word sort of name.
There's a company that begins with a T here that snapped up a bunch of, has an app that runs on our phones up here in Canada that has a bunch of different subscriptions in it. But and I'm sure that's going to make people like Condé Nast, you know, just have a fit over the competition from Apple. But interesting. All right.
Continuing right along the money train, Apple is doing more subscription stuff, according to folks who have claims here. So this didn't come from the beta. This is coming from sources within Apple, and this is on Cheddar's website. Cheddar's news site, and they're claiming that there would be a gaming subscription service of some sort, saying it would function right. like a Netflix for games. It's unclear to me precisely what that means, given that, you know, games on iOS today are a little bit different than what they were, you know, 10 years ago. It's a lot more freemium sort of games and other things. It's not clear how this would work. If you were to assume it's like an all-you-could-eat sort of deal, like you would get with Netflix, where you can view all the movies, all the TV shows, it could maybe be more akin to Xbox Live or PlayStation Network, and maybe Apple might try to bring in that side of the enthusiast gaming sort of things. I really don't know. This is article's pretty light on the details on that, but it is interesting to see that Apple is doing that. And of course, with developers, people should absolutely be, you know, keeping abreast of this sort of thing to think, oh, if this is what Apple wants to do to earn its money, how can I build my business, or should I even build my business on that?
Yeah, there was some backlash. I saw, I posted another thing in here from a 9to5 article about the same thing, about they're reportedly planning a Netflix for games sort of thing. And I think some of the game developers that I follow were up in arms a bit about this, because, you know, why would you spend all this time? And then how are they going to vet who gets into this service and that kind of stuff? Like, you know, Apple tends to be pretty picayune about who they let into the sort of premier things, and that, you know, I mean, mind you, I guess the days of being an indie developer have been gone or dwindling for many years now, right? So it reminds me, my response to them was, well, we already have a system like that. We've got that set app system where I still have a subscription to, and they're always introducing new apps, and they have a vetting process as well, right? So I pay like, you know, I think it's $14 Canadian or $11 US, I think, per month to have access to these apps, right? That would otherwise cost me what a year subscription would be anyway. So
yeah, I mean, pure speculation here, but I could see that it might give an avenue to sort of counteract sort of the downsides we've seen and talked about on the show about freemium type games, where if you were one of the lucky handful of chosen folks allowed into this subscription service, it seems to me that if you were guaranteed some base amount of revenue, it would change your incentives maybe enough to say, you know what, let's just make a cool game instead of making something, you know, cynically that would try to, you know, addict people or draw them in to spend more. Like, look, Apple gets its money. I get guaranteed money no matter what. I have more of an option to take risks of, like, yeah, let's do like some cool art thing, kind of like Monument Valley sort of thing. I'm hoping, like, I'm more on the positive side, given that Apple hasn't told us anything about it, that it will be a positive thing in general for the industry.
Well, I think game apps are the top seller on the App Store, right? I think, if I'm not mistaken, like in terms of where the revenue is. I think that bodes well, but it doesn't make, and maybe Apple is trying to control some of the copycat games that we've seen over the years, you know, and some of the poor exploits, let's put it that way, in, you know, of bad games that are sort of cheesy and, you know, too many ads in them and that kind of stuff, right? So a lot of, like, you know, we get copycat, like we had that whole thing with Flappy Bird. We had Flappy everything for a while, right? So
yeah, I'm hopeful that this will, like, here's the positive side of it that I could see, like, if I was a product manager at Apple, it'd be like, look, if you just give us $5.99 a month, you have unlimited access to these games, and I would really target more the, like, parents with kids, and instead of worrying that you, like, gotta lock down your iPhone so that, you know, Jimmy and Sally don't end up buying $500 of Smurfberries, it's like, yeah, go play these games, they're all vetted, I know they're gonna be, you know, fine, and go have fun, and then hopefully the incentives are aligned for the developers to make these games, you know, fun for people to play, and safe for the kids, if that's the route they go, rather than having to be, like, super defensive about, like, how does this work? And then, you know, lawsuits that people have had against Apple and Amazon and Google regarding, like, hey, my kid charged up my credit card and it's not good that I didn't have tools to prevent this sort of thing.
Well, I was going
to
say, what do you think is going to happen to the in-app purchases? I mean, because I think for a lot of games, that's where the revenues are, right? Like, I guess
that's where most of the revenue is for games like Zynga games, that kind of thing, the freemium game.
Yeah.
It's hard to say. You know, it would be really interesting, and I'd have to think through whether this actually makes sense for anyone, but it would be real interesting if Apple did something like made the subscription cover all games. So every game in the App Store becomes free, and your subscription pays for access to every single game you want, and you as a developer get paid by the amount of usage of each app. Wouldn't that be kind of interesting?
Right.
So that would take away this whole, you know, exclusive club of, you know, who Apple chooses to include, and it basically it would just be, you know, if you got a good game and people want to play it, then you get paid more. You get paid by the time people spend, as opposed to the number of times they download it or buy things. It'd be kind of interesting.
Yeah, sort of like the click model at the web app.
Yeah, in some sense. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
No idea if that's what they have in mind or if that even makes sense, but it's kind of an interesting thing to think about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. What else has 12.2 got for us, Jaime?
It's funny, we were just talking about this like gaming sort of thing and just all you can eat. The 12.2 beta apparently also has customizations for downtime where you can, you know, put limits on yourself for the kind of apps you're going to use and usage and stuff to sort of like wean people if they want to away from, you know, using social media at like the middle of the night sort of thing. I don't use downtime myself, but I was not aware that it didn't really have the ability to set separate schedules for different days. And you could see like either for yourself or for like kids, you might say, hey, look, on the weekend, fine, go play like 8 hours a day, you know, knock yourself out. But on weeknights where you're supposed to be doing, you know, homework and you got to wake up the next day, nope, you get an hour and you got to be done by 9.
Right. Does Apple have like a do not disturb kind of time frame? Like I remember BlackBerry used to have this thing where you could say like from 7 p.m. till whatever, don't even, like, you know how we have the do not disturb? They sort of had that thing where you could set a schedule every day that just your phone just wouldn't ring unless it was an emergency or something, you know?
I think so. So the only ways that I've used do not disturb is in a very limited access where it's, just go and do not disturb because I'm going to walk into the movie theater or something and I'll remember to turn it off when I come out. And I think they upgraded it a version or two ago for like on my watch. It'd be like, hey, you want to put this on for like an hour or until tomorrow or till you get home, I think there's an option for that. So I wouldn't be surprised if you could do that.
So there is a scheduled option. I'm looking at it right now where you can set do not disturb to turn on from a certain time and to a different time. But it doesn't look like that's too customizable. Like you can't make a different version for weekends and a different version for weekdays or something like that.
Oh, I see. Okay.
All right. What else you got?
More stuff coming out of the 12.2 beta. So Steve Charlton Smith, one of those folks who likes to reverse engineer this stuff, has found references that he believes they're references to 4 new iPads in the Wi-Fi and cellular variants, and apparently without Face ID, and a possibility of a 7th gen iPod Touch. So we've got an article linked to The Verge that sort of describes and summarizes this in the show notes. So as you drive it home, I think you should really click through to the tweet itself so you can see sort of what we're talking about in terms of what he's looking at. Like iPod 9.1 gets a little arrow of iProd C-cert, which is weird. iProd, it will nudge you for health and purposes.
Interesting. So we have a 6th generation iPod right now?
I guess. This is like a fact check sort of thing.
I think there is a 6th generation. Yeah.
Really? Yeah, because I had a customer ask me to dumb down one of my apps because he was running it on an iPod and it couldn't run anything higher than 9. I'm not sure. Uh-huh. iOS 9 that was, right? Uh-huh. So yeah, because I had updated it because I wanted to put stickers in the app. He asked me to dumb it down. So last release, I just dropped it down one version.
Yeah, that was that sort of iPhone 5 equivalent iPod, right?
Right, yeah.
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 That doesn't even run 64-bit, 32-bit only.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Just the last note on that one is it doesn't surprise me that, I mean, it's been so long that I didn't even know the answer to what gen of iPod are we on. But it doesn't surprise me that this year Apple would be reconsidering it because we've mentioned that the growth is not going to come from selling ever more increasing quantities of iPhones. It's going to be on things like subscription services and offering other devices. Like last week we mentioned, hey, they found a whole bunch of iPhone SEs just hanging out in Tim Cook's garage. So they put those for sale to, you know, scrap out every little bit of money that they can to replace revenue streams.
Cool. All right. Well, my next one is a quick hit from Walt Mossberg. I read him on Twitter. A couple of things he pointed out, and this is in anticipation of the numbers coming out yesterday, I think it was, right? So this is probably Monday that I put this up here. Just quickly, he was talking about, it's likely true that Apple was victim of overpricing in the mature markets like China and stuff like that. But he goes on in a subsequent tweet to point out that, you know, they only brought brought in 84 billion in 90 days as opposed to 93 billion. So 84, you know, that's still quite a bit more than what most companies do. But he also pointed out that the Mac alone, if you just took the Mac business alone, it would still be a Fortune 500 company. So, you know, this is under my category of doomed, Apple is still performing pretty well considering they're not, you know, meeting what people are expecting them to do. And I think that, Mark, you have a post here.
So, of course, Apple had the earnings announcement on Tuesday. Today, we're recording this on Wednesday, so it was yesterday. And it was kind of what everyone expected, and even actually maybe a little better than a lot of the analysts were expecting. There were some analysts still expecting a lot more gloom and doom. But, you know, we all suspected, talked about it last week, that most of the bad news was probably already baked into the stock price. So people were pretty much, you know, aware of all the negative stuff and were ready for some good news. And it turns out, the Wall Street was pretty happy with the earnings announcement, actually, because the stock went up today $10. Granted, that was up from the pretty depressed price relative to a few months ago of 154 yesterday, and it closed at something like 165 today. So there was an interesting article today in, I think it was in 9to5Mac, called "The Four Reasons Apple Stock is Up Despite Weak Guidance for Q2, for second quarter." And it is true that the guidance was a little bit weak relative to last year. What guidance means is Apple says, or every company, when they give their earnings for the previous quarter, they give a number, an estimate of what the earnings for the next quarter is going to be, and the revenue for the next quarter. And they were guiding 55 to 59 billion for next quarter. That's compared to last year's Q2, which was 61.1 billion. So it is down a little bit, not down as much as this quarter was compared to last year. And if you're wondering why it went from 84 to just under 60, well, that's, you know, the 84 was the Christmas holiday season. So it's always a much better quarter than Q2, which is traditionally a slow quarter because everybody spent all their money and bought all their toys over the Christmas timeframe. So they don't buy them in the first quarter of the year, the calendar year. So anyway, so according to this article, which makes a lot of sense, the four reasons that Apple stock went up is that first, the bad news was already baked in, and the earnings report was not as bad as some people might have expected. In fact, maybe it was a little bit better than what they expected, since all the bad news was out and there's some signs that there are good things to come in the future. The stock went up. It was probably a little bit oversold, which means that it was the stock was artificially lower than it probably should have been. The second one is that even though the iPhone revenue was down by something like 15%, services revenue was up 19%, which is pretty good. Related to that, the third point is that for the first time, Apple revealed its margin on services, margin being the amount of essentially the amount of profit that a company makes on a particular product. The gross margin, which is just the revenue minus the cost of goods, was 63%, which is pretty good. So this is for services like Apple Music, iCloud, and Apple Pay. That for every dollar that they're earning on these services, their 63 cents is essentially profit.
That's what they're keeping, yeah.
Yeah, so that's pretty good. So I think that surprised people, analysts, on the upside. That was higher than people expected. So since the services the business is growing and it's very profitable, that means that the company's going to make good money on that in the future.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Right, and stable money that isn't based on like having to grow and acquire new users. It's just continuing to get this $9.99, $12.99, whatever it is per month for Apple Music and other bits.
Right. And let's see. Now I'm looking for the fourth reason is that the overall gross margin, not just the services gross margin, but the overall gross margin for the company is between 37 to 38%, which for a hardware company, that's actually pretty good.
It's amazing, yeah.
Yeah, for software companies, it's probably low, but you know, Apple's not a pure software company. They make most of their money on hardware. So 37 to 38 is pretty good. So yeah, so that's four reasons why there's reason to be hopeful for the future of Apple, and Wall Street rewarded them for that and rewarded investors like us.
So the next story I saw on our Marco's tweet yesterday was talking about, and it's kind of blown up today, and Apple's even reacted to it. But yesterday it was reported that Facebook has been has a sort of a I don't know if it's an enterprise app or whatever, but it's a research app. They're calling it Facebook Research, where they were basically paying kids or young teens and other people to install an app that would feed back information on what, you know, purchases and habits and that kind of stuff like that. It seemed to be a little underhanded that, you know, they're paying $20 a month to, you know, people 13 to 35. I heard reported earlier today that it was around 5% were actually, you know, in their teenage years, but still it kind of raises a big specter about how Facebook is, you know, working around Apple's rules and regulations to sort of get an app like this out here. I don't know if you guys saw anything about this.
They were in fact using the Enterprise Developer Program.
Yeah.
So it's expressly against the rules to do what they were doing. So that's meant for internal app development for customers within your own company. And it's forbidden by Apple to ship the app to people external parties outside of the company. Even worse, to charge them $20 a month for it.
No, they're paying them $20.
That's what I meant. I mean, sorry. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. Well, it'd be worse to charge them, but yeah, paying them is bad too. Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, there's all kinds of, I mean, it's been reported all over the place about this particular thing. I think I've seen this tweet and this article tweeted out a number of times in the last 24 hours. And a development on this, again, reported by Cheddar earlier today, was that Apple has blocked Facebook's dev access. I'm not sure if it's probably just to their enterprise account.
Right.
They've blocked access to this as of this morning or sometime today.
Yeah. Right? As much as Apple might like to, I think it would be impossible for them to block the main Facebook app at this point.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah.
Or remove that from the store.
Yeah. So you guys have any opinions on this whole Facebook fiasco?
Yeah, it's not too surprising that Facebook was doing this, given some of the other stuff they've done. And I think Apple did the right thing by pulling it.
Right.
Yeah, it's interesting that one of the implications was that all of Facebook's internal folks were unable to use their internal builds of the Facebook app. Like, you know, if they have like side-by-side the App Store version and like, hey, I'm on the iOS team, I'm working on this. Mm-hmm. Like, that stopped working because that cert got pulled. I do think it was an appropriate response by Apple. Like Mark, I don't think that it's feasible for, you know, just practicality reasons to, you know, Facebook is just so big, removing their app from the App Store would be probably a bridge too far because Facebook has enough, you know, resources to try to work around that somehow. On the other side, I think it starts inviting questions about business practices and does Apple have a monopoly if it can destroy an app's, you know, sort of place on the App Store like a Facebook. And I don't, like, I wouldn't want to get into that game if I was in Apple's executive team.
True.
And I do wonder, like, just how publicly Apple came out on this. I do kind of wonder if it's a little bit of a slight overreaction based on the FaceTime thing. We're going to talk about spoilers. We're going to talk about that later this episode. But it strikes me that normally, you know, Facebook is so big, they would get treated differently. And like, yeah, I would kind of expect there to be some behind the scenes, very heated phone calls. Like, what the hell are you guys doing? We're going to pull this cert. And maybe they pull it, maybe they don't. But to like very quickly slam the door and publicly say like, yep, that's why we're doing this. Don't do this again.
Do you think there was actually a conversation? Do you think that, like, I guess Facebook, you think Facebook is that big that Apple would not just go ahead and just pull it and then let them go and, you know, file a complaint with Dev Relations or something like that? Like, I mean, we all have to do.
I do think so, because if it was my app or your app, like personal stuff, like our apps would be completely gone, and I'd be shocked if my Apple ID wasn't starting to do funny things too.
And we'd never be able to publish again. That would probably happen to us, right?
Yeah, and it'd be like an Apple employee driving up to my door, coming in, breaking my laptop, and then writing me a check for the sum. But it's new. Like, they would just completely stomp us. I have no illusions that Apple would just, you know, destroy us personally. But Facebook is big enough where they have, you know, the ability to fight back. And this is the strongest sort of response I could possibly realistically see.
Yeah. So I have a sidebar question related to Facebook. I've seen a lot of celebrities, internet people, you know, Walt Mossberg is one. I have a couple of friends who are sort of in the you know, the sort of tech business, fairly well known, who are leaving Facebook. Like, they're deleting their account, they're walking away, and that kind of stuff. In my case, we use Facebook to communicate with friends and family. I mean, that's, you know, we try to educate the people who we see online who are you know, retweeting or sharing these bogus stories and stuff like that. We try and get them wise to the fact that that's not really a legit story, but you know, it's how our family stays connected and that kind of stuff. So I want to know what you guys think about the impact of leaving Facebook. Does that is that really going to make a difference at this point in time? I mean, they have, what, billions of people on the platform, right? What do you think?
Well, impact on what? I mean, the reason for leaving Facebook is because you don't want them using your information for their own gain.
Sure. Okay. But is, well, I mean, I guess the question is to these people who are leaving, like, what is their motive for leaving? Like, it seems to me that from what I'm gathering from these people is that there's been so much fake news and this kind of stuff, like this exploit lately, and, you know, accounts being, you know, compromised left, right, and center, you know, all the bad press that Facebook's gotten over the last year. But you think leaving a platform is really going to have, at this point in time, I mean, like, there's so many people on this platform that one voice, no matter how popular or famous that person is it really going to have an impact? Like, would you leave Facebook?
I don't use Facebook. Well, I have an account, and
right,
and, you know, people will sometimes send me stuff, and I will respond in that case. But I never initiate. I never post on Facebook. That, I know that's going to shock you.
Absolutely, I'm shocked to even look at. I'm shocked you even open the executable. But yeah.
No, I mean, I don't. So I don't like the fact that they're selling your data, selling people's data, and the whole existence of the company is to sell your data, to collect and sell your data.
True. Yeah.
So.
And I guess that's the main motivator for people, right? But but we've known that they're selling our data for a number of years now, right? It's not like that's news. How they're selling it, or look, this thing about this, you know, paying these kids $20 a month, that's a new development, right? The effect that they have on the Canadian elections and the American elections and that kind of stuff, and the fact that they can spin false news, and unfortunately people are going to fall for that, right? But my question is, like, do you think leaving at this point in time, do you think one person leaving or two people or 10 people leaving is really going to have an impact?
No. Of course, it's not going to. A couple of people leaving is not going to have any impact on Facebook. Of course not. But if enough people feel strongly about it, then it could force them to change. And even if it doesn't change the way the company does business, you can at least prevent them from profiting off of your information if you choose to.
True. Yeah. What do you think, Ami?
I use it as out of practicality, friends and family sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I mostly view it as like a read-only thing. I do post a handful of things, but it's largely consumption, which is quite a bit different than what it was for me. I don't know. Hey, I guess, you know, say like a 10 year ago, it's sort of challenge. The irony. I'm thinking of it. All right. I'm going to imagine, you know, put yourself back in Star Wars: A New Hope. Do you remember when Obi-Wan Kenobi and Luke Skywalker were there in the desert, and he's like, Mos Eisley Spaceport, you will never find a more wretched hive of scum and villainy. They didn't want to go there, but they had to go there.
Right? That's
sort of the relationship between me and the Facebook app, unfortunately. And it's weird because, like, you know, I know people who work there. I've known people who work there.
Yeah.
And it's a bunch of really, really smart people. It's just somewhere in that company culture, there's either really, really dumb people or people who are making very cynical, villainous type decisions. And it's really troublesome. I think that's why, and we'll need to talk about this more when it comes to the FaceTime story, as I think this is getting lumped in together with the FaceTime story, and that kind of offends me because I think it's a very different kind of problem. Mm-hmm. And this is probably a good time to mention that, Google was doing something like this too, with its ScreenRise Meter app, and they quietly decided to remove that and said, let's not have our enterprise developer account removed from usage. So
also Google self-regulated themselves, you mean?
Yeah, I think somebody over there was smart enough to maybe not do the decision of not to implement this app, but certainly was wise enough to see the writing on the wall and say, oh, Apple slammed Facebook. They're almost certainly going to slam us given our history.
Wow. Yeah. Well, and there was another report I heard. I think we talked about this briefly, this Facebook, there's a new Connect thing or something that's coming out, like a group-wise thing or something like that. You guys don't know what I'm talking about?
Are you talking about the portal device, or are you talking about like a replacement for Facebook groups, maybe, based on the way you're saying it?
Yeah, I gotta go look up the name. I can't remember what it was called. It'll come back to me, but we can move on. We'll talk about it. If it's significant, I'll bring it back. So what's next?
I wanted to bring up this article by Bloomberg. I think it's Mark Gurman. Is it Mark Gurman? Mark Gurman and Debbie Wu talking about stuff that is supposed to come for new iPhones. And at the very tail end of the article, a little bit of stuff for iOS 13 that's being claimed here. So the bigger things related to the iPhone are supposedly that Apple is testing this camera setup with a laser system, a long range system that will help depth finding for, let's say, like photos, but also supposed to make the augmented reality experience that much sweeter. So I'm very excited about that, because I think for the past when did Project Tango from Google come out? Let's say like 2011, 2012, so 7 or 8 years, I've really desperately been wanting for that sort of sensor to be on the back of an iPhone. Mm-hmm. At that time, it was for sort of mapping the local environment around you, because I was working at Point Inside on indoor location systems. But here, and just seeing how well augmented reality and AR kit works today with the system we have, I'd be really, really excited to see yet another thing that can make it even smoother and more realistic. In the middle of this article, it talks about the fact that Apple is testing out iPhone devices with a USB-C port inside of the phone itself, opposed to, let's say, like USB-C on the end that goes into the wall. And way, way, way down at the tail end of this lengthier article, it's talking about updates to iOS 13, which apparently will include a dark mode, which kind of isn't surprising, given that there's a dark mode in Mojave, implements CarPlay, some iPad-specific upgrades, like a new home screen, which has no description whatsoever as to what that means, like what's new about it, and other things. I'm actually pretty excited about the idea of dark mode, because I don't know, every app on the iPhone that lets me switch to dark mode, I do. I switched my Mojave desktop to use dark mode, and every app that supports that is great. And when I switch over to like Chrome that doesn't have it yet, it burns my eyeballs.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, I don't know. I tried dark mode for a while. It's funny, like my QuickTime is stuck on dark mode. On my Mac. I can't figure out why. Is your QuickTime in dark mode? Yours, I guess yours is, but Mark?
No, mine's on not. Your, no.
Yeah, so like the little recording window I have right now, it's dark, and whenever I go to save, I get the dark mode dialog box, so very strange. Yeah, like it's stuck. Interesting. Yeah, I tried dark mode on my test device here for a little bit, and I noticed at nighttime the desktop changes into like a dark dune, but I did turn it off.
Yeah, I think it's a very personal thing for folks. Some folks like
it. Do you use like a midnight theme on your Xcode as well?
I do, and I think Xcode is one of the apps that I'm not super happy with how it looks in dark mode.
Right.
For the most part, it's okay. The thing that really bothers me is the color scheme for when you are searching for, like on the, it's like a little sidebar on the left side, so we hit what, command 2 or 3, I think, and you're searching for find references to this particular class.
Right.
Something like really difficult on the almost pure white text, I think they chose for the search results, and then this blinding yellow for the highlighting of the search result. It looks much better in normal light mode than it does in dark mode. And I'm not a designer, so I don't know how to fix it, but I know that it's quote-unquote wrong as far as my personal opinion is concerned.
Is it not using your highlight color from the general preferences on your machine?
I suppose so, but I didn't tinker with those in any way.
Okay.
So yeah, I assume that other people who use Xcode in dark mode are seeing the same thing that I am.
I think mine's still that sort of robin's egg blue that I've never changed it, the highlight color on my Mac. So I think that's probably what I think I see in Xcode in white, in not dark mode. What do you call it? The not dark mode? Not dark mode?
Normal mode, I guess. Yeah.
Light
I don't
mode?
Know.
I don't know.
Yeah, light mode would make sense.
So I just tried turning dark mode on and off and opening QuickTime while it was in dark mode and then closing it and then opening it again. And it switches back and forth just like everything else. It's fine.
Right. Well, must be just my weird machine. So while we're on the subject of Xcode, how about that object library access in Xcode 10? The fact that it's now a floating palette?
Oh. I'm okay with that.
Are you? Are you in there a lot, though?
Yeah. I mean, yes. I don't know. I don't have a strong reaction to it.
No?
It's okay.
Okay.
You don't like it?
I don't know. Every time I go look for it, because I leave my object library open all the time in Xcode 9, and if I find in Xcode 10, the fact that I have to go, and it's a floating palette, and I can't snap it to anything. Like, in all the Adobe products, you can pull things out and make them into floating palettes, but you can also snap them back into their little sidebar thing. Mm-hmm. So I find it a little bit odd. But I did find the key command. I think it's command option I or L, one of those two that opens the library for L. If you hold the option key down or shift key when you do the command, it stays open. So if people are trying to figure that out, try that out. All right. So what's next, Tommy? Tenure challenge?
Yeah, this is an article on Medium by Valia Havriliak. I'm really terribly sorry if I've gotten that name incorrectly. This is 2 weeks in a row that I'm challenged with that. So I apologize, but it's just a really quick, fun little article. You know, so on Facebook, with enough irony here, and Instagram, there have been these posts going around, and everybody's sort of like going into this like viral mode of like, oh, 10-year challenge, a photo of yourself 10 years ago and one today. To sort of so like growth or change or whatever. And that's kind of the premise of this particular post, where it shows like the App Store and eBay, Evernote. I didn't even remember what Evernote looked like back in 2008. Facebook has changed quite a bit. Instapaper, OmniFocus, even pCalc shocked me. I thought its design scheme had stayed fairly consistent, but it actually has gone through quite a bit of change. That was kind of fun to see how things have sort of changed over the years. And then you can sort of guess as to the why. Some of it is the change between, you know, pre-iOS 7 and now post-iOS 7 design thinking. There's the notch that goes in. Some of it is just like branding sort of stuff. Like Evernote, for example, seems to have really de-emphasized the green. It was very, very heavy green with the elephant before. Now it's a little bit more subtle. Hmm. So I don't know that there's any like amazing insights, but it's kind of a nice little, you know, blast from the past.
All of my images here in this flawless thing, I think I'm being punished by the medium, because I'm not seeing anything in all the images are blurry.
Oh, medium for me occasionally decides it doesn't want to show photos or videos. So you just have to refresh it until it stops doing that.
Really?
Yeah. And for example, I'm going to throw some shade in eBay's direction and some side shade, some accidental bystander shade on Kijiji. I really, really hate the eBay 2008 app. It looks, I don't really like the current app as a user. It's weird and confusing. It looks horrific. And it looks like he throws the shade on Kijiji. It looks like the weird Kijiji sort of theme for the 2008 eBay app.
But that's old.
Yeah, it's very old.
That's probably why they changed it, right?
It's funny, you know, when I was thinking about this the other day, that I've got a couple of books. I think one called Don't Make Me Think, and it was sort of a book on web development and how to design web pages and stuff like that. And the two sites that they pointed as being really well done were Amazon and eBay back in that book. Remember how Amazon used to have all those tabs across the top?
That's right. Yeah. You know, I could see at the time at which that book was written, that would make sense. Because like competitors would be like, I don't know, Craigslist and Toys.com or something.
Right.
So I could see, but even those two examples that you've given have definitely evolved, and it's really sort of changed where I think a lot of stuff is based on more like you are either searching from like an Omnibox sort of thing, yeah. Google style, yeah. And it just sort of, the machine is smart and like, oh, clearly you wanted this thing. Or it's been more contextual, like, oh, it looks like you are in this location, or it looks like you have this other thing going on, so I'm going to just infer where you want to go instead of trying to do maybe more effective wayfinding, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, yeah. I just find it ironic that they were used as the gold standard of sites back before iOS came along, and Android, I guess, too. Oh, look, another post here on 12.2, Jaime.
It's the gift that keeps on giving. So this one is a tweet by Federico Vidici talking about the iOS 12.2 beta, introducing support for the WebShare API in Safari. So you know those nifty little... Yay. Sharing sheets you can bring up in your apps. Apparently, there's some markup you can do in the web, too, in Safari. That's pretty neat. I don't know that's like, you know, this isn't like an earth-shattering thing. This seems more like a quality of life thing.
Right. That if you, from a website, you can call one of these things up. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
JavaScript?
I'm not really sure like what sort of official support will come in here. But if you look at the photos, again, we'll have that in show notes for those of you driving at home. You can see that he created a little web page with, you know, a big old button that says, tap this. And it brings up the sharing sheet, and he can see AirDrop, and I forget what these things are called on the little like actions. It's like app style actions in more like contextual type actions.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Mm. And I didn't know that there was like a web share API to do that. I'm very unclear if that's like a standard thing of like a web page can ask, yo, operating system, open a sharing thing if you understand that concept.
Yeah, no, I hadn't heard of that either. It was something my clients would have asked for sure. All right. Mark, what do you got here?
Yeah, this is probably not news for anybody now, certainly by the time that the podcast comes out. But Apple had a little issue, a little software bug that really came out in the last day or two, although I guess it's been around for a while, but it really hit the news the last couple of days ago. And of course, this is the FaceTime bug that I'm talking about, where it turns out under certain situations, which are pretty well documented online, we don't need to go into them, if someone's calling you on FaceTime, then
they can hear what you're saying without you actually answering the call, and even see your video through the phone, even though you haven't answered the call. This is obviously a huge privacy issue and a major bug. So there's mm-hmm. a lot of press about this. I suspect that actually by the time the show is available or soon after, it'll be fixed. But for right now, it's a big issue. So it's probably a good idea to just turn off FaceTime for now, and unless you're actually planning to use it for something, just turn it off. You can disable it in settings and avoid this from happening, because basically anyone could call you, and even if you don't answer the call, they can still eavesdrop on you.
Yeah, it was based on the FaceTime chat that they added in last year, I think. It's actually when you, it's not the first caller, but if you it's adding a second caller, would the first caller, if they hadn't picked it up, that you could hear what they're saying and on their in their environment or whatever. It was like they butt dialed you, kind of thing, right? And you could hear what's going on.
I thought, but the first person they call, if they just add someone else to the call, they can hear what the first person.
Yeah. That's kind of like, but it was part of the group chat thing, and Apple yesterday had taken down, late in the day, they had taken down the group chat service. So you can still go in, and I went in and turned off my FaceTime on my two devices and my two Macs, but I didn't go to my wife's computer and do hers, because I know she uses FaceTime with her granddaughter, right? But and I would have to support that if it wasn't working. But what's interesting though is that it was discovered by a young teenager. I think a 12-year-old had discovered it and told his mother about it, and his mother spent a week trying to get through to Apple on how this exploit worked, and she tried customer support, and she tried a whole bunch of avenues. And we all know from sometimes talking to Apple, they can be a little thick-headed when you try and communicate with them. But their solution was, or their suggestion was, that you open a developer account and file a radar, right? And I tweeted out earlier today, I don't see how, I mean, some of us have a hard enough time just filling out a radar anyway, because they ask for a whole lot of detail beyond, the what is the bug and how to manifest it. They want you to know how to reproduce it, and they want steps, and they want screenshots, and sometimes they want logs. And I don't see how a 12-year-old or even his mom would be able to navigate that kind of a
I hadn't heard that, but that sounds like a terrible answer.
Yeah, that was the answer that came out today. And yeah. I mean, I mentioned it yesterday in our Slack that I was slipping by CBC News, and our national news broadcast was going to cover the story. And what was interesting was the reporter who did it spoke to a security expert using FaceTime, on his iPad. So that was kind of an interesting irony there. Mm. But I mean, they did it on purpose, but it was being reported like oh my God, this is a horrible privacy breach and blah 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 from Apple, and reporters are reporters, and they're gonna write the headline to get as many eyeballs on the story as they can. But I worry that these kind of things get blown out of proportion. It was in it's in all the newspapers, and it's on every channel and that kind of stuff. And it's a huge issue. It's a huge issue, Apple did react quickly by taking it down. I mean, notwithstanding, they didn't react quickly based on the week it took for these people to get through to Apple that there was a problem. And I think they probably reacted once it broke and went viral, right? So I think somebody posted a video, and that's how it got out into the wild on the Twitter and Facebook world, right?
Yeah, and I think quick depends on where you start the clock. Clearly, and we'll unpack this a little bit more. Clearly, there's a big issue with the point at which Apple understood that there was a problem, yeah. Right? I think it was unaware for a big part of that week until the right people looked and said, wait a minute, what? And it seems like they turned around very, very quickly to have, the immediate sort of feature flag to shut off the group chat. And then there's supposed to be an update reasonably soon. Like, a week is really fast when you have like a billion devices out there to brick everybody's device. And surely we, on this very show, we complained about iOS 8 and when it launched and made it so that people couldn't use their brand new phones to make phone calls, right? Like, you don't want that to happen either. It's certainly slower because there is like the weird delay. And I do think, sort of working backwards, there's like something that needs to be done done so that it is more obvious that these sorts of like legitimate security issues, people have a really easy path to get attention into the right hands, right? Like customer support, like no, like customer support has to work at scale. There's no way this person probably thought, oh, okay, you know, they did the wrong thing on FaceTime. They didn't understand the flavor, right? Because they're used to people like not understanding how to FaceTime their grandkids, right? That's what they're trying to do. And then I think there's also sort of the problem of like, how did this get through QA? Like how did nobody find that? That's a huge problem.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
Like on the development side, like why is it that this thing is even possible? Like it just doesn't make sense in your whatever architecture you have. Like I know bugs happen, but it seems weird that you could force the audio to show. And I don't know if this article covered, but a different article said like, oh, you can also get the video to happen too.
Yeah.
By like canceling the call or doing some weird other thing. Like that just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So there's this whole slew of things. But I wanted to come to the point where I mentioned it earlier show that I felt kind of offended, similar to the reporter thing you were talking about, where it's like, oh, I saw one of two things. Either, oh, look, Apple talks so much about privacy, but here they clearly don't care about privacy. I think that's pretty offensive because like this was very clearly a mistake, right? Tim Cook wasn't sitting in there in his villain's lair saying, ha, 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 look at this thing I'm going to do, right? I'm going to force Jimmy and Sally to code in this horrible privacy bug. Why would he do that? I don't think he would do that. And the other thing is people saying, oh, well, see, it's almost like whataboutism. Like, oh, see, it's just as bad as Facebook and Google. I was like, no. Facebook and Google allegedly did their things with full intent, right? This was an accident we would rather see Apple not have happen,
right?
They're not a scrappy little startup. They're a very well-funded company who has resources to prevent this very thing from happening. And they have really good resources at their disposal to rectify it faster than they did. That's very different than like, you know, execs somewhere in Google and Facebook being like, oh yeah, we're going to do this thing and like, forget the consequences. Money's all that matters. That's what I assume happened here. Right? Here, I assume it was like, oh crap, we had a series of breakdowns of the process and this thing happened and they've worked as fast as they could to deal with it. And I think it's not fair to the companies involved. And I don't think it's fair to the public to try to conflate the two because it's very, very different.
Yeah. I mean, they could see it easily slipping through because, you know, from the perspective of you want this service to work so that, you know, a grandmother can talk to her grandchild kind of thing. Like you want a 4-year-old to be able to enable FaceTime and you want the grandmother to be able to, you know, doesn't have to be tech savvy is my point to get there. So there's going to be a lot of negotiation that happens between the two devices. You know, we all understand how these, you know, data streams work and how they have to be encrypted and all that kind of stuff, but how you want to make it as seamless as possible. And that could have been something that was just missed, some one small piece that got overlooked in the QA process or even in development process, right? Because it's a new service that's being piggybacked onto an existing service. So things can happen. Things can get overlooked, right?
Yeah, it was definitely a very ugly week for tech. It was a lot of things coming out.
Oh, here's one thing I posted too. This headline from New York Times. Apple was slow to act on FaceTime bug that allows spying on iPhones. I mean, admittedly, like I heard about this, you know, in the morning, like around 9 or 10 in the morning, you know, and then, you know, I think Apple had it shut down by early afternoon, if not in the evening, right? So, you know, by the time it hits the sort of airways and becomes public and Apple, like you said, did shut it down pretty quickly, even though, like I said, it did take a week for this mother to get through to Apple, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Back in my day, he says with as crusty a voice as possible, back in my day, you had 0-day exploits in Windows or in Internet Explorer or any number of things, and you really just hoped that the next patch Tuesday of the month, you know, the once a month patch Tuesday would end up with fixes for that exploit, right? Like here, like,
right, yeah.
Clearly it shouldn't have gotten there, but I think it's reasonably fast at scale. It's like, all right, somebody thought about maybe we should make it possible to take down group FaceTime. Okay, good. Kudos. That was a good design decision. They took it down and they're going to be issuing a patch, you know, reasonably soon, certainly before, you know, patch Tuesday style, you know, hopefully next month sort of thing. Wouldn't be surprised if it shows up in one of the new betas. Wouldn't be surprised if 12.2, when it becomes released to production, has it. Could definitely be faster. There are tons of ways for it to be faster. Whether or not, you know, I was talking about like where you start the clock. I think there's nuance there, but the fact of the matter is it still took a week for Apple to realize and then fix the bug. And that really can't happen.
True,
like,
true.
It's not like, whoops, you know, we've got, you know, billions of users and we only have like 10 people in a co-working space in San Francisco. It's like, no, you have hundreds. that you have thousands of employees. Like, you can very clearly say, this one person, their sole job is to just look at all these reports and be like, I think that's a possible security bug. Send it to engineering for triaging. All right.
Sure. Yeah. So this New York Times article goes on to say, and they point out another side of things, which we've talked about on this show before, is that there are entire organizations out there who are looking for exploits in OSs, and they offer bounties to people to report them, but keep them secret so that they can take advantage of them, right? There's one talk here about Zero Diem, a well-known broker and security firm, raised its reward for an Apple iOS bug to $2 million. So $2 million will keep something quiet for quite a while time. And this is not Apple paying. This is like somebody trying to keep this particular exploit open. Apple, in fact, offers, I think, a bounty of $200,000 to hackers who can find things. Because the question was, what is this woman and her son going to be rewarded, if anything, for finding this thing and bringing it to light, you know? So, because they didn't go, I guess they went to the papers to try and get somebody to pay attention, but at Apple, but, you know, like, obviously this, by bringing it forward and trying to get Apple to pay attention to it, I mean, they did quite a service to Apple, you know, by keeping at it to make sure that they knew about it, right? Rather than throwing up their hands in frustration, right? By the way, Grant Thompson was the 14-year-old boy in Arizona who discovered the FaceTime bug.
Yeah, I hope it gives the right folks at Apple pause to, you know, take a step back and rethink some of their processes and how they handle things. It certainly could have been worse. There is a very silly lawsuit out in like New York or something. I'd have to find the link of somebody who was claiming that they had an iPhone with them while they were giving a deposition. Now their privacy has been violated, even though, again, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a judge. I don't think there's any grounds for damages because they'd have to show that somebody did in fact listen in using this technique. It certainly could have been worse, right? This is not the same level of Cambridge Analytica. It's not the same level of oopsie, like Experian. Sorry, Equifax had with regards to data breach. I still don't think it ever really should have happened. But on the other hand, bad things happen and it could have been way worse. And hopefully this ends up with renewed emphasis on security, right? Not to say that Apple doesn't take it seriously, but like, I feel like this could have been caught elsewhere. It's speculating maybe in code review or in architectural design, or it could be in QA. And at the very least, if you can't make those any better than they are, because stuff still happens, the mitigation side of like, all right, something has happened. How quickly can we realize and rectify that something has happened? That part needs to be taken care of through the, you know, customer support being better trained at like, here's what you do when you think you have one of these situations, or even just updating the darn website. I looked at the link that was in one of these articles, like, I wouldn't know where to go to report to Apple the security problems. I'd probably just go like at Apple, at Tim Cook, at Johnny Ives, just for giggles. Be like, hey, I found this problem. Somebody hit me up, slide into my DMs and I'll tell you more.
Yeah, actually, that's what I was going to say, because I was thinking about that. Like, what would I do if I had found something? I mean, you know, I know to try and get a hold of some people at Apple Canada that I know, and I also know to file a radar. But yeah, like I said before, I don't know how a regular person is expected to understand, you know, how to get through to Apple's
team. This is certainly not a developer issue, so it doesn't feel like radar is really the right place. You would think that in this day and age, Apple would have a, you know, big prominent button on their website somewhere saying, "Hey, have a security issue? Do you want to report? Press this button and fill out this form, and we'll get right back to you."
Well, most websites have most mail administrators have an address, abuse at blah 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 domain, right?
Yeah.
And the idea behind that is if somebody forwards a spear phishing campaign to you or whatever, you can send that to that address, and you would think something like that would be available, like, you know, right. abuse at right. Apple or right. you know, exploits at Apple or bugs at Apple or whatever, you know. Maybe there will be maybe that will come out of this, that there'll be a page on Apple's website where you can try and contact them. Operative word there being try. And that's try with a question mark, because it could be an optional. You might get nil back, right?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. More than just good. There you go.
Yeah, I saw an interesting article, an interesting tweet the other day on the three types of try. I don't know if you guys have ever looked at that, but the try with a question mark is like, you can use it like optional chaining, I think they call it, where instead of having, because normally with try, you have to have a do and a catch, right? And mm-hmm. The do does a thing and catches the error, and you deal with the error. print it out or whatever you're going to do, right? With a try with a question mark, basically will return, kind of turns it into an optional, so you don't have to do the do and the catch, but yeah. So but it can return
it will
nil.
Or it
can
fail, except it'll just return nothing if it fails.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah. And you can test for try that way too to see if it comes back as an optional, treat it like an error, but you don't have to go through the whole that whole do catch thing.
Right.
And then the try with exclamation point is the good old force try, which is, you know, as people say, whenever you see an exclamation mark in anything in Swift, you should approach it with caution, right? So, because it basically will force it to try, right? So, and potentially crash. So that's the code part of more than just code, right?
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Yeah, I think the try with a question mark option that you're talking about is something prior to the codable, you know, encodable, decodable stuff in Swift was pretty common for me to see in parsing JSON, where you might realistically expect, like, oh, maybe we'll have this element, maybe we don't, sort of stuff.
Right.
Where you may not want to do a, like, well, the entire thing fails if we're missing this piece.
Yeah, now I got to find that article that I just talked about.
I will use that one in places like a core data fetch request requires a try when you execute it. And usually in a case like that, if it fails, well, you know, I just don't have the object, so I move on. So I don't really need to have the full do catch mechanism for something like that. So I use them typically. I use them actually fairly often.
Mm. Yeah, technically, I should say that it's for any kind of method that can throw an error is when you use try, right?
Right.
That's
right.
What I should have said. Yeah. All right, well, let's take a look at our picks for the week. So, Jaime, do you have a pick?
I do. The conference videos for iOS Conference Singapore 2019 have come out. And I apologize, I've not seen any of these. These just came out today, so I haven't had time to watch. There are like 18 videos as of the time of this recording. And there's some that stick out to me as ones I want to add to my list, like, oh, I just lost it. Swift 5's brand new results type. I'm aware that it exists. I'm curious to see what somebody using it out in the real world has run into, because I'm very interested to see if we can, you know, remove our own bespoke home-rolled versions of that, or if maybe there are some downsides to it that I'm not aware of. And I'm also interested in, where is it? Ah, there we go. The underestimated power of key paths, because key paths seem like a very interesting way to do a neat KVO style and KVC style programming that I've briefly used, but haven't really, like, truly learned what sort of power is there.
I thought you were in Singapore.
No, I guess full disclosure, I did submit, but was not selected for iOS Conf Singapore. But I wish them well, and clearly they had very good sessions, even without me.
Mm-hmm. So we haven't talked about Xcode 10.2 beta that came out this week. Have we talked? You guys know about that?
The one that includes Swift 5?
Swift 5, that's right.
Wow, yeah. No, I haven't tried it out. Have you tried it out?
We talked about it. I haven't downloaded it yet, but we also talked about the possibility of downloading the Swift 5. Toolchain from swift.org and sticking it into, you know, Xcode 10.1 and just seeing what's in there. Of course, the compiler and all that kind of stuff isn't going to be quite right, but something you can play around with. So if people are interested in looking at, and of course, that means we're getting that sort of that promised ABI compatibility, so we'll have smaller binaries, and hopefully we'll get to the point where we are with Objective-C, where it won't really matter what version of Objective-C you're using. It kind of just automatically will compile, right?
Is that actually in the beta? Is that confirmed?
I believe. Yeah, there was a note in the release notes about the fact that there are going to be smaller binaries and that kind of stuff. So whether that's air quotes confirmed or not is another story. I thought we talked about that in our Slack. Some guy from Fruit Company posted something about that. You didn't see that at all this week in your tweets and stuff? Not that
I think
you spent any time on Twitter.
Slipped past a lot of people, because it is a little weird to see like a minor version of Xcode end up with new stuff like that. It is exciting that it's coming out faster. Definitely want stability in Swift. I want it to still improve, but I still remember the bad old days just after WWDC and the 0.1 days. I don't really look forward to those. And it's been, is this year five? I guess it is year five. Huh? In 2014.
Yeah, 2014. Yep.
Yeah.
Last time I was at WWDC.
Time flies.
Been 5 years since I was at WWDC. But yeah, it says, this is what people were posting this picture. It says, Swift apps no longer include dynamically linked libraries for the Swift standard library and Swift SDK overlays inbuilt variants devices running on iOS 12.2, Watch 5.2, and tvOS 12.2. So it could be that it's only going to applicable to newer devices running the new OS. As a result, Swift apps will be smaller when deployed for testing using TestFlight or thinning an app archive for local development distribution. I'm not sure what that means, but that was the piece that people were passing around a couple of days ago. Still there?
It's good news.
I was trying to decide whether to say this one or not, but it will eliminate an excuse I've heard from certain very large companies that say, oh yeah, we don't do a lot of Swift because, you know, it bloats the app sizes. Like, your app size is over 250 megabytes when installed. So I kind of think that Swift will not significantly impact this noticeable size of your app. Yeah. Please don't tell me that. Just own up to the other realities. I can guess what they are, and I think I know what they are, but, you know, just own up to it. Be on the up and up.
Yeah, they're not using PDF icons is what it is. All right. So my pick this week is a playlist on YouTube that of a bunch of commercials that Apple's come out with. The one that led me in here was how they made these commercials using an iPad Pro. They filmed them, they lit them, they illustrated them, they did the music in GarageBand on them, they edited them in a couple of apps that run on iPad Pro. So they actually filmed these commercials. There's like six commercials here. They filmed them on the iPad Pro, they edited them, and they produced them on the iPad Pro completely. But the series of commercials that have come out with, or series of short videos, I guess, have come out with is how to create a presentation, you know, using different tools like Keynote and that kind of stuff, and how they kind of work together. A new way to take notes is another one. One called A New Way to Design Your Space, which includes an app, Trace, which is like a new architectural drawing, kind of like AutoCAD kind of thing, where you can basically scan your empty space and, you know, use the augmented reality to measure the size of the room. And you can, using other apps, you can download furniture and VRs of furniture and fit them in the room and see how it would apply. Another video here is a new way to go paperless, which is how to, you know, use your iPad to capture a document and digitize it rather than, you know, having to keep the paper, that kind of stuff, or dealing with receipts and different things like that. And there's even one here that's really disturbing to me, and that's how to make your own podcast using an iPad Pro. So that includes recording it, editing it, and all that kind of stuff that I do painstakingly every week in Logic, and we record in QuickTime, and, you know, we do double-ended recorders, that kind of stuff.
I think you just need to get an iPad Pro then.
Yeah, clearly that's the one, right? So,
but it's a business expense. It's a tax write-off.
You,
<That's right.
laughs> you have to have the business to have the expense. Yeah, that's one thing I keep reminding people when they say that. Yeah, I guess I could use it as a tax write-off, but I don't write off enough tax to equal the price of an iPad Pro these days. But yeah, so again, it was, I'm trying to remember which one it was. Maybe to go behind the scenes. Yeah, a new way to go behind the scenes, I think, is the video that covers the how they made this series of videos, which is kind of interesting. So it's kind of cool if you're interested in how, get some tips on using other apps to do different things. You know, there was one that converts text into print and that kind of stuff, or into text, I guess. Yeah, quite a few interesting bits and pieces on how to use iPad Pro exclusively, which I'd love to do if there was Xcode on iPad. Although, how would I compile my programs?
Remotely on via some sort of iCloud AWS style system for the low price of $9.99 a month.
Yeah, that would be a good idea. Yeah, compile in the sky. What could possibly go wrong with storing your stuff in the cloud? No.
I didn't have anything witty. I really desperately wanted to add something witty, and I did not have anything.
Yeah, what could possibly go wrong? All right, well, I guess that's it for the week, Jaime. So if people want to get in touch with you, how would they do that?
I'm on Twitter as @devwithahair.
All right. And Mark, if people want to get in touch with you?
MarkR@smapsoft.com.
All right. And as usual, my name is Tim Mitra, TimMitra on the Twitter machine is how to get in touch with me. And until next week, we will say bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
If you want to find out more about the podcast or see the episode show notes, visit the More Than Just Code website at mtjc.fm. You can get in touch with us on the website or follow us on Twitter at @mtjc_podcast. If you have feedback or questions, send us a tweet with the hashtag AskMTJC. If you like the show, please consider recommending us to a friend, writing a review on iTunes, or pledging any amount at patreon.com/MTJC. You can find details on how to help us out on our website at mtjc.fm/sponsor us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
over. Yeah, I don't know how I managed to do it, but I forgot to eat dinner tonight.
I was a little surprised by that.
Well, I start recording with Tammy at 7, right? So it's 12:30 now.
Yeah.
You've been doing this for almost 6 hours straight then?
Yeah. Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Max asleep on the couch over there, which is where I should be. But yeah, lots of fun.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Today was a work from home day, and yesterday was a huge snowstorm, so I worked from home as well. So, or actually, Monday night was a huge snowstorm. So it's pretty cold out there.
Yeah, I like working from home.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, you know, a couple of weeks ago when I wasn't on the show, Jaime, you asked how many people are doing Windows, and it's surprising how much Windows I do these days, particularly when I work from home, because it's gotten to the point where unless I bring my Mac home, I really can't work on code. I have a PC that I keep here just to, you know, do all the regular email stuff. And we use, conferencing software for meetings and stuff like that. So, you know, either I'll dial in or I'll use the audio on the computer. But yeah, I'm using a Lenovo. No, is it ThinkPad? That Lenovo? I don't know. One of those things.
Yes, Lenovo owns. Yeah. It used to be IBM, but it's Lenovo that owns ThinkPad now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so to answer your question, a couple of times a month, at least I'm on Windows for, you know, better part of a day. Huh. So, yeah. Because I don't like the idea of, I don't have to bring my computer home every day, so I don't, you know. I just leave it at my locker at work. So on Windows a lot. More than I'd like to be on Windows, let's put it that way.
You know, I guess it's kind of appropriate that we were talking about the, like, gloom and doom and, oh no, like, Apple's, they're done, they're dead. And I was like, well, actually, they're like 9 billion short of what they wanted to be, but it was 80 some billion dollars. I mean,
yeah.
People were saying, like, Microsoft's dead a long time ago. And it's like, they maybe weren't very relevant culturally for some time. But if you looked at their quarterly reports, they're doing pretty nicely and they're distinctly not dead.
Yeah. Well, we wouldn't know what to do with $1 billion if somebody handed it to us. Like, even if we burned it, it would probably take us better part of a year, right? You know?
I bet somebody has done the math on that. Probably depends on... Are we talking like the Joker in the Dark Knight sort of thing, where he's got like a big fat stack upon fat stacks of cash?
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
mm-hmm.
He was burning like, what, $20 million or something in that scene?
Was he?
I think.
Which Joker was this? Or
this is Heath Ledger. Remember he was burning the mafia, the mobsters' money? They're like, what are you doing? He's like, it's not about the money. I don't care about the money.
Yeah, well, that scene was Walter White.
I'm looking up now, what's the largest denomination bill you can get right now? And it looks like there used to be a $10,000 bill, but it's been discontinued.
Mm-hmm.
So the largest, the largest one is a $100 bill. Kind of surprising.
There's no $1,000 bill anymore?
There's no $1,000 bill.
Ooh, really?
There used to be $500,000, $5,000, and $10,000, but they were discontinued in 1969. So yeah, so $1 billion in $100 bills would be a pretty thick stack. That would take a while.
I feel like it's a math stat of, like, you know, how close to the moon, if you had single dollar bills, could $1 billion get you?
Yeah, it sounds like a good one of these outside the box interview questions, right? Of how long would it take you to, given with one lighter, how long would it take you to burn $1 billion in $100 bills? I don't know what the answer is.
I have no idea. It's an unholy amount of money.
And I think the out of the box answer would be, well, I would run out of lighter fluid in the lighter before I could do it.
Yeah, but you can buy more.
Wow. Are they all touching each other so that we're guaranteed that the small amount of spark eventually consumes it all?
Yeah.
I don't know.
It looks like $1,000 or $100 is our Canadian one as well.
So I'm surprised it stopped being a denomination. Like, I assumed, Mark, that you were going to say, because of the digital age and not moving as much cash as much. But in 1960-something, it's way before computers would have taken over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, that's interesting. On July 14th, 1969, the Federal Reserve and the Department of Treasury announced that banknotes in the denominations of 500, 1,000, 5,000, and 10,000 would be discontinued due to lack of use. Although they were issued until 1969, they were last printed in 1945. They printed enough in 1945 and kept them in some vault somewhere in the Fed building and probably in D.C. somewhere for 24 years until they ran out.
Well, in Canadian money, there's $1,000 bill stopped being printed. This article is from 2012, and it says, I guess around 2002, they stopped printing $1,000 bills here.
Hmm.
I don't know who's on the front. There's a picture of the back. But it says that there's a million of these, as of 2012, there's a million of these still in circulation. But they think they're all in the hands of criminals. Yeah. Money laundering experts. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. I wonder how that worked. I wonder if it was more recently, I want to say it was India had decided that it was going to change its currency somehow. And certain bills were going away. And it's like, you had until a particular date to go to a bank and like exchange it for a new currency.
Yeah.
I mean, that's consumers, right? Like, I assume that only banks were hanging on to the 1,000 and 10,000, and it took them, 20 some years, I think I heard, from 1940 something to 1960 something.
Yeah. I had a few friends who went to India the last couple of years. I asked them if they'd bring me some money, but they didn't. And 2016 was a demonetization of the rupee, Indian banknote.
Oh, okay. Okay. What was the particulars of that? What was.
It says on November 8th of November 2016, the Indian government of India announced the demonetization of all 501,000 banknotes of the Mahatma Gandhi series.
What was the reasoning behind it? Was it like a security thing that they wanted new bills?
The government claimed the action would curtail a shadow economy and reduce the use of illicit counterfeit cash to fund illegal activity and terrorism.
Oh, okay. I see. Yeah. So the denomination as a whole went away, not just like some particular printing. Like in the U.S., we are changing from like old $5 bills to new $5 bills, right?
Yeah.
And this is like $5 doesn't exist anymore, as an example.
Yeah, I think that was the case. Yeah.
Okay, so they wanted to go for digital currencies or cashless economy sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
No, I think they still have the big bills, because it looks like they still have 1,000 rupee and 2,000 rupee bills. But
So then I'm very, very confused as to why those particular two were chosen then.
No, maybe it's just because they're harder to produce or something. I don't know. Like, a few friends of mine at work have told me some of it, but they did it once in 1946 and 1978 as well, to combat tax evasion and black money held outside the formal economic system.
Hmm. It reminds me, I have some Canadian bills that I have no good idea what to do. Like, I should try to figure out what the denomination was worth and then maybe just hang on to them until it goes up to that point so I don't lose money. And then factor in the time value of money and how it's been probably
it'll be a long seven years
since I went to Vancouver, exchanged, and then forgot to exchange on the way back.
Did you not go to Chateau Montebello?
I did. I don't think I paid for anything in cash or not enough that I still have these bills hanging around.
Right.
I mean, it's not like a fat stack. It's like probably less than $100 worth of what might as well be Monopoly money, because nobody's going to take it here and have to go get it exchanged like at the airport or something.
So you can't take it to a bank and change it? Like foreign exchange?
Probably, but it's probably like the worst place. They're probably going to get like a really poor rate.
Yep. So our chatbot's on the street now in TD app.
I forgot what the name of it was. What was the...
Clary? Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know.
Is that like on an announced website somewhere, like td.ca or something?
Yeah, I think it was a link on LinkedIn. There's a couple of articles posted there where I put a like on them. Ooh, look, it says hello again. It also, I've been here before.
Wait, I must have misspelled that. How do you spell Clary?
C-L-A-R-I.
Oh, there we go.
Oh, she's telling me how much money I have in the bank right now.
Oh, I see. So like clarify, probably?
Oh, I don't know.
Or clarity?
I don't know.
I'm just guessing because, like, I assume that Bank of America's Erica is like, well, it's a real name and it's, you know, contained within the word America.
Yeah, Siri Bob.
Oh, you know, that's funny. It never occurred to me until just now when you said that the reason they chose Erica was because it's Bank of America.
Yeah, don't feel bad. Like, Erica's been out for quite some time. And then one day they sent yet another email about, hey, use the same. Say, wait a minute. But months after the fact, I realized that that's what they had done.
So, Tim, how come you guys didn't name yours Mini?
Mini? Why would we name it Mini?
Because it's Toronto Dominion.
Minion. Mini
it's M-I-N-N-I-E is what I was thinking. That kind of...
Yeah, no, it's also Canada Trust. So what do you get out of that? T-R...
Trudy?
N-A... Or D-A-T-R... Dart?
I mean, it could be an homage to Ada Lovelace's Ada.
Yeah.
Yeah. So wait, is Alexa, does Amazon? No, there's no connection there. That's just completely made up, right?
Not as far as I'm aware, unless it's like Jeff Bezos's like love child or something they were going to discover at some point in the future during the divorce proceedings. I'm not aware of any relationship it has to like the history of it.
Yeah.
It's Siri. I mean, Siri was an acquisition, but was the original company, did that have any meaning? Do we know?
I mean,
I don't know. Like, was it like the founder's friend or dog or girlfriend or?
Yeah, I don't know.
I have no idea what
they
what
acquired the origin Siri. Is. I didn't realize that.
Yeah,
back in the day. Yeah, yeah. It was an app on the App Store prior to the acquisition.
Oh, really? Was it really?
Yeah, I'd never used it. You know, prior to being integrated into iOS.
I had never
5. Heard. I want to say
that's Google Siri.
Let's see.
Go to the Wikipedia.
Yeah, assistant names. Like, I mean, the most boring one is Google Assistant. Well, good job. I really wish that Microsoft hadn't dropped the ball with Cortana.
International, Mark?
What?
It was developed by SRI International.
Ah, well, there you go.
Yeah, theory. Yeah, cool stuff. Almost forgot. I got to buy tickets tomorrow. Oh, yeah, Thursday, 10 a.m. My alarm going to go off.
To like a concert? What tickets to
Yeah, Steve Hackett's coming back. He's going to be playing around the corner from my house.
I just noticed that. Yeah, I got an email during the show, you know, one of these, you know, blasts from Ticketmaster saying he's coming.
Yeah.
So I got to check that out.
Yeah. Do they have a pre-sale? Do they have a pre-sale or what?
I don't know. I haven't checked.
Yeah, I saw him just on his last time he went through. But it's funny. They're using the same word for all the concerts. So, you know, for the pre-sale. So I got tickets for Santana. I got tickets for The Who. I got tickets for King Crimson.
We did get King Crimson. Good, good.
Yeah,
you'll enjoy it.
I got too many tickets now. So
yeah, you can never have too many tickets.
Yeah.
Well, unless they're all for the same show and you can't find someone to take one off your hand.
Oh, that's right. Friday, I got to go see a concert. Better remind my sister about that before she forgets. Probably already forgotten.
There's a Richard Thompson concert tomorrow night that I'm not going to because it's too far down in Santa Cruz. That'll be a real pain, but he's good. Mm. Have you ever seen him live?
No.
You know who he is, right? Who's he? Richard Thompson?
No.
Oh, yeah, you should check him
out. I know a guy named Richard Thompson, but it's not the same guy.
Probably not. Yeah, so he used to be the guitarist for Fairport Convention way back when. Mm-hmm. Way right. back when. But he's been solo for like 40 years now.
Oh, I think you told me about him before, right?
Yeah, and he's sort of a folky kind of guy, but not, you know, not like super, super folky. But he's an amazing guitar player, and he kind of does a singer-songwriter kind of thing now, and he's just got an amazing tone to his voice.
Right.
So he's really entertaining. The only problem, though, all of his songs are just super, super depressing. Somebody always dies or something at the end. Yeah. But he's really, really good. You should check him out. You should Google, Tim, you should Google 1952 Vincent Black Lightning on YouTube. Look it up on YouTube. That's kind of his most famous song. And you will say...
What's it called?
1952 Vincent Black Lightning.
Okay.
Are you doing it right now in real time? Real time follow-up.
It's coming up. It's coming up as a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll listen to it later when we get off the call.
Yeah. Yeah. I suspect that you'll say that. You'll see that and say, "Wow, I should see him live."
Really?
Yeah,
really?
I don't know. Very different than Buckethead, though.
Yeah. What did I hear about Buckethead the other day? I can't remember now.
Good things? Was it good things or was it related to a scandal? Did he get an ill-advised tattoo?
I think it was a guy I follow on YouTube, the guy who does the video or does the music breakdowns. I think he was talking. He did the top 10 guitarists of, you know, or the best guitarists or whatever, and Buckethead got a mention in there. Has a particular style, right? So a friend of mine just got back from Cuba, and she's like, "Look at the snow! Oh my god, poor girl, just stayed in Cuba." Wow, minus 20 degrees. That's crazy cold.
Sorry. I've been watching the video.
What video?
Richard Thompson.
Oh, have you? Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm gonna get out of Dodge and talk to you guys later.
All right. Have a good night.
All right. Talk to you later.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details. Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.